This is Sharp Money with Patrick Maher on VSiN, the sports betting network.
Hour number two of Sharp Money, live from downtown Las Vegas, Bar Canada at the D. I'm Ben Wilson. You see Jared Smith looking to potentially make a bet with our producer Wyatt Jontek here as well.
I just made it.
It was a classic. We muted Jared's mic because we wanted to see him potentially get in a bet. The reason why we're gonna talk about it right now, because Paul Skeens, who has already been off to a great start as a rookie, has honestly defied all the loftiest of expectations for him, and today has been the coup de grace. 7 innings, no hits, 11 strikeouts in Milwaukee on 99 pitches. Could they potentially send him out for the 8th inning? It's not unrealistic to think so, but the bigger story now, while Skeens is actively moving here in the award markets, he's now minus 700 to be NL Rookie of the Year at DK. You feel like...
Yeah, that's done.
That has officially been locked up after today, but he's now the fourth favorite in the NL Cy Young race, and has moved from, at one point, 30-1 to 25-1. After the 5th inning today, he was 18-1. Now, Jared, he is 14-1 behind only Zach Wheeler, Chris Sale, and Ranger Suarez. And you were looking to see if you could pick off a nice little number still out there Paul Skeens.
I just bet at 18-1 still at MGM. It's coming down now at DraftKings. Let's leave it at this. If he finishes this game as a no-hitter, it's going to move down even more. I mean, I think right now, I think he deserves to be the second favorite next to Wheeler. I think he's right there with Sale, and I think Wheeler's maybe slightly ahead of him just based off of tenure. But this is his 12th start, right? Like, this is like we're getting to a point where, all right, the hype is now over. I know it's a bad number, or I wouldn't even call it a bad number. I would call it a number that I think will continue to move down. Do I think he can win this award? Meh. It all depends on whether or not he's going to get shut down in September. I still don't know the answer to that question. But right now what I'm doing is I'm buying myself some time. 18-1, which is probably MGM's a little bit slow sometimes to move the futures market. There's our pro tip of the day. DraftKings a little bit quicker. FanDuel's a little bit quicker. Some of the bigger box shops are a little bit quicker. Not a knock. I just think it's just the way that certain books are set up. Like, for example, Circa won't even put those numbers up, day of. They'll take them down, and then they'll put them back up in the morning, and then once the game starts, they'll take them down. Whereas the big box shops leave them up even as guys are pitching, which when you're a guy like Paul Skeens and you've only made 11 starts, this is 1/12 of your entire season today to leave up a futures market when you have the potential for something historic to happen. Has a rookie ever thrown a no-hitter? Valenzuela, probably? I mean, I don't know if a rookie's ever thrown it. I'm assuming no. I would say Valenzuela is the only one I would think of.
Great immaculate grid question.
I don't know. Someone could look that up. My brain's not a computer.
There's not many options. That's the issue. Yeah. Right? So you know.
My brain's not a computer. I don't know if a rookie's ever thrown a no-hitter. I'm assuming no. Valenzuela is the only guy that would come to mind that's done it. But my point being, this is now we're on the precipice. We're past the rookie of the year stuff. The rookie of the year stuff is in the rearview mirror. He could probably get shut down and still win rookie of the year. That's how good he's been.
How many people, what would you set the over-under wide? Number of MLB rookies who have thrown a no-hitter since 1901.
Ooh, you're going to get some weird stats there from the early days. 4.5.
25.
Oh, geez.
That's a lot, actually.
Wow.
How about this? Bumpus Jones of the 1892 Cincinnati Reds.
How many have thrown in the last 10 years?
In his first Major League game. Bumpus Jones in his first Major League game.
Paul Skeens and Bumpus Jones. I mean, those guys, I'm sure, they pitch exactly the same.
The last one was Clay Buchholz in 07.
Okay,
That was his
almost
second Major League start. How about this? Charlie Robertson in 1922. Perfect game in his fourth career start.
Yeah, I think anything after 19, let's call it 70, I don't think, when did they move the mound up?
Right.
Like,
That was the Bob Gibson rule.
So in the 40s,
that was,
50s?
That was, 60, I think
so
60s.
So anything before that is really tough to really compare. So let's go just a generic number in the last 50 years. How many times it happened? Maybe five
it
times?
It looks like it has since the 50s, really since the 60s, it's been three times.
Three times in 60 years.
Wilson Alvarez, White Sox, 91. Okay. And then we mentioned Clay Buchholz, Red Sox, 07. Actually missed. Tyler Gilbert, this was just a few years ago, 2021, in his first Major League start.
Yeah.
For the Diamondbacks.
So we're on the precipice of something historic. I don't know if he's going to finish the game. I think he's going to come out for the 8th. I've been teetering on this for the last few days. I was very skeptical with the early love on Rookie of the Year. because I didn't know if he was going to get shut down. Then the more that I watched him and started to prod people who had watched him last year and have context on him, telling me that he is not your average rookie and he is not a guy that is going to have those, you know, swimmies on, the protectors on.
Floaties.
I don't know, man. Maybe depending. Maybe it's a soda and a pop thing. Whatever part of the country you're in, you call him something different. He seems like a guy that is going to – he has the moxie to go the distance, right? Like, he might be a guy that if the Pirates say we're shutting you down, he's like, no, you're not shutting me down. Like, I know that's probably not going to happen, but – I don't get the vibes that the Pirates are interested in shutting him down. I haven't heard anything. This is all just speculating what the Pirates have done and what other teams have done in years past with rookie pitchers. So it's not fair for me and anyone else to just assume he's going to get shut down. And the better he pitches, the less likely he is he'll get shut down. I think the only reason that he would definitely get shut down is if he hit a certain innings threshold and then his stuff started to get worse. But now we're at start number 12 and it looks like he's getting better.
And this all goes into the point of if you were guaranteed, this is start 11 today, and he's at,
start
even
11,
if he doesn't come back out, at 66 and a third innings, if you could guarantee he's about to be, if Pirates the Pirates hang on to the 1-0 lead, 6-0 with about a, his ERA is now sub 2. In 11 starts as a rookie. If you were guaranteeing me he would get, let's just say for sake of argument, 21 starts and about 120 innings, you would absolutely make that bet. And the number, if you were guaranteed that, would probably be more, it would be in the 2-3-1 range as opposed to the 14-1 that it is actively coming down to.
Yeah, I think he would be right on par with Wheeler. I think Wheeler's numbers have been good, but I'd be willing to bet that if you looked at the wins above replacement schemes, it's probably, now Wheeler started more games, so he should have more wins above replacement. There should be a gap there, but I wouldn't be shocked if the gap is smaller than we think it is, considering Wheeler's probably had 5 more starts at least.
Wheeler has made 8 more starts.
8 more
2.9 WAR. Skeens coming into today was 1.7. But, that WAR is going to be in the low twos after today. So he'll be less than one WAR behind Zach Wheeler, and that's in 8 fewer starts.
And now we get the lightning strike, the no-hitter. Now, he hasn't done it yet, but...
Don't give him the announcer's jinx now.
There is no... I don't want to get into it. There's no announcers.
But Baxter, bark twice if you're in Milwaukee. Our headset is not sent into the Pittsburgh dugout at American Family Field.
I think there's a chance that... Oh, I'm hearing it. We're hearing some barking. The dogs are barking in the background.
Really?
No, in our headset.
Taylor Sperling, our outstanding audio engineer.
Taylor's playing...
Baxter, you are.
There you are. Hey! That number is going to come down. Skeens of 14-1 is going to come down. Obviously, the 18-1 price that I just bet at MGM is absolutely going to come down after today.
Ben, the two things here, one about this game and one about Skeens. I love that the guy that ruined the perfect game for him is probably the worst hitter in the lineup for the Brewers, Garrett Mitchell. Drew the walk.
The walk. Pitch, right?
158 average. But two... How much are, like, just the Nationals organization is punching air that they, because it was the MLB lottery was the first time last year they weren't able to get the number one pick to get Skeens. If it wasn't the lottery, they would have been the true number one team to have the pick.
Like the one time that it happens to this magnitude. Although having said that, the last time there was a pitcher of this magnitude, the Nationals got him, and it was Steven Strasburg. Now
well,
there
they
was
did
a lot
World
of
series with
yeah,
him. So
I'll
you know
be
what
honest.
Got.
I'll be honest. I have no sympathy for the Nats in this situation. Didn't they get? Yeah. It was James Wood. When was he drafted? He's pretty good. They just called him.
Well, they
up.
Got him the number two pick. No, that wasn't this year. That was Dylan Cruz. My apologies.
James Wood didn't get drafted this year, but I thought James Wood was a very high draft pick, and now he's looking great. I don't know, but the MLB draft. To
yeah,
me
if you're
is
saying
kind of
if you're gonna if you're saying you feel bad for people based on an MLB draft, that is the least predictive of the four major sports. Yeah, it's hard. Stop. To really
I mean,
go
I don't
there.
Know,
but I get what you're saying. Wyatt. It's the one time
the
Pirate, it happens.
Get the Pirates something. When was the last time the Pirates had a big,
Bill Mazeroski
pitcher like this? Was it Garrett
Cole? Pirates have had like
big, big names, you know.
Well,
Bill
the
Mazeroski,
Pirates have had like six number one picks in the last 30 years.
It is really hard to get a number one pick right in baseball. I'll be honest, unless there's an obvious guy like Skeens, it's hard to get draft picks right in baseball. These guys don't play in the majors for 5 years.
Skeens is out, and on the second pitch from Colin Holderman,
base hit. All right, good.
So the no hitter broken up. Skeens,
get him out now.
Fire the manager.
Pitches.
Fire the manager.
Get him out now.
Okay.
Now you got to take him out of the game.
Okay.
Well, Skeens is out of the game.
Oh, they took him out.
Yeah,
he didn't start the 8th inning?
Yeah. Colin Holderman.
Why wouldn't he start?
Great name for a guy trying to get a hold and get it to the closer.
Why wouldn't he start the eighth inning at 92 pitches?
Well, 99.
99,
but, I mean,
okay.
I'm with you that the whole 100-pitch threshold is very much overblown. I mean, Skeens, his last three innings, I think, threw like a combined 20-some.
It was under
25 pitches his last three innings.
I hate that they didn't bring him out. But I still feel good that the number's going to come down still. He just threw 7 no-hit innings against a team with one of the best run differentials in baseball, and he struck out 11, which was a career high. There's no way that number's not going to keep coming down.
Well, now that he's out, Brewers plus 145?
Yes.
I mean, in all seriousness?
Yeah.
It is Garrett Mitchell, bottom of the order, up right now on that. The other games in the day slate that have gone final, Reds knock off the Rockies. Rockies' dismal road record continues. Hunter Green back to really good form today, is about a $2 favorite, 8-1. David Peterson in the Mets. Peterson's had pretty good numbers. You've tracked this all year,
yeah,
Jared. The lefty.
8-0 in the first inning. Nerf.
That, too. 7-0 over the Nats, who have really faded. They were a very trendy NL wild card team. That has really faded fast now. A Mets win is a minus 145 favorite there today, and the only other game going right now, Giants get two in the bottom of the first on Kevin Gausman. So, hey, at least if you're going to be wrong, Jared, on a no-run first inning,
yeah,
at least you're just
really
all
wrong.
The way wrong. 3-2 there, Blue Jays in the first inning. Runners on first and second here for the Brew Crew. Now, even money. I wish I would have not. I wish I'd have stopped talking and done what Jared did at the start of this segment.
That's the problem with doing the shows. It's really hard to live bet. It's really hard to live bet.
All right, we'll get him next time. When we come back, it's about that time. AFC East. We dive in, starting with the Miami Dolphins. That's our first team up. We'll break them down on the other side of this break.
This is Sharp Money with Patrick Maher on VSIN, the sports betting network.
Hey, the NFL preseason kicks off in less than 1 month. How about that? Lucky for you, the VSIN experts have been hard at work this offseason putting together our new NFL betting guide. To access this guide, you have to be a VSIN Pro subscriber. For a limited time, we're offering an unbeatable deal. Get a full year of VSIN Pro for just $199 instead of the usual $240 price. And as a special bonus, we'll add an extra month for free. That's 13 months of access to everything VSIN offers, including daily best bets, around-the-clock video content, premium analysis, exclusive betting splits data, and all of our special edition guides to keep you informed and winning throughout the year. Do not miss out on our all-new NFL betting guide with this great offer. You just go to VSiN.com/subscribe, use promo code SHARP, and you get 13 months of VSiN Pro for only $199 and get instant access to the NFL betting guide. We've waited long enough, Jared Smith. Time to dive into our NFL division of the day. Well, when you have a near no-hitter by a rookie sensation, it's only natural.
And now they're about... Oh, actually, they got a couple of outs here. So
come on, Bryce Turing. Let's
Holderman's
go.
Trying to stick to his namesake here and hold this lead.
Now, if you missed it, Paul Skeens, 7 no-hit, 11 strikeout innings today. Pittsburgh leads Milwaukee 1-0 there in the bottom of the eighth. The Skeens was taken out before going out for the eighth. We'll update you on that as the afternoon continues. But right now, Jared, it's the AFC East. Miami Dolphins is where we begin. And it's a really polarizing division, probably the most polarizing of any in the NFL when you include the New York Jets, who we'll talk about a little bit later. My big question coming into the year for Miami, there was this natural sense of pessimism when you lose a respected DC of the ilk of Vic Fangio. And obviously, based on some of the quotes that came out of Miami, it was that this youth movement of one of the youngest coaches in the NFL, Mike McDaniel, as the head guy, kind of meant that that old school hard hat approach was not really welcome in South Florida, which from a wins and losses perspective, to me matters more than the TikTok social media perspective. So that's why I just naturally felt a little bit pessimistic about a team that lost its most important guy at a DC perspective and also lost two really, really key pieces on the defensive end as well, led by Jalen Phillips, who had that crushing season-ending injury. And I just don't know what to expect now out of Miami on the defensive side of the ball, first and foremost.
Yeah, they lost a piece to Vegas, right? Wilkins, I think. So they're a little bit thin up front. But the things that I really like about Miami, if you're betting an over, if you want the optimistic case, is their schedule starts out relatively simple. They're favored, actually, according to DraftKings, in each of their first five games before the bye. And then after the bye, they're favored again in their next two games. There won't be a dog until week 9 at Buffalo. And again, the game on Thursday night, home against Buffalo, that's a tight line, but they're favored by a point. Favored by more than a field goal against Jacksonville, obviously favored by more than a field goal against Tennessee at home and New England on the road. That game at Seattle, right now they're a 2-point favorite. Of course, Seattle, I think, is a difficult place to play. I could see Seattle, if they start fast with a new coaching scheme there up in the Pacific Northwest, I could see that number coming down, and maybe it's more of a pick 'em as they get close to game time. But my point being, if you're looking to bank wins in an over situation, you've got the right schedule. They're also a six-point favorite after the bye against Arizona, and then they're a slight favorite, basically a pick 'em, on a long rest break week after the bye at Indy. I mean, you could legitimately see them starting 6-1. And that's what they've done in prior years. Yeah. Very fast out of the gate. But then you go to the back half of the schedule and things get a little dicey. Those last four games. Look at those last four games. At Houston, Niners, at Cleveland in a primetime, at Jets. And then, oh, by the way, that stretch starts with the Jets at home. And then they play in Green Bay on Thanksgiving. Frankly, those last six games, I think they're fortunate that they're going to be favored in any of them. So that's a really tough finish to the season. And we know that Tua's had struggles finishing seasons. So when you look at their schedule, to me, it's an obvious path where I would expect them to start fast. And I don't really know what we're going to get after that. I think the defensive coordinator situation with Anthony Weaver coming in is exciting, but we'll see how long it takes to adapt. I think you have a core in place that I'm very optimistic about, but the schedule is very lopsided. I think I would be willing to bet an over on them, but I would not be willing to bet a divisional title. I would not be willing to bet anything in the AFC Championship or Super Bowl. Here is how I would play it. The only way I see Miami making a Super Bowl is if they are the number one seed, because we saw what happened when they had to go to the Ice Bowl in Kansas City last year. This team is not built to play in cold weather. They have to be the number one seed. Or they have to be the number two seed, and they have to get lucky that the one seed loses in the divisional round, and they don't have to go to Kansas City or Baltimore in January. I think that's the only way this team makes a Super Bowl. Or Buffalo. That's the only team. Or Cincinnati. Like that is the top four teams on the AFC odds board are arguably the worst four destinations for Miami to be playing a January outdoor football game. So the only way I see them making it to the end of the rainbow is if they get the number one seed. I'm assuming you can get a pretty decent price there, comparatively speaking to what their number is to win the AFC.
Yeah, no question. And I'd also add just a couple of small things, too. It's on the schedule. They're always a team where you like to see those colder weather teams come to you early in the year. Remember the Buffalo game, the absolute asinine game early in the season a couple years ago. Well, that game this year is on a Thursday night. That's we're kind of picking nits here, but that is
the fact
you don't get that game at 1 p.m. Eastern time. You can finagle with the stadium set up there and make Buffalo play in 110 degree heat when your sideline's like 75.
Yes.
That to me is significant in a division where the Bills are favored, a team we will talk about a little bit later in the show. The fact that you don't get that. Week one is Jacksonville, a team that is as prepared for that sort of environment as anybody, because
very
your
true.
Training camp environs are basically the same. I look at things like that with a team that ended up the season, because of the way they closed and struggled, to your point, Jared, basically middle of the pack. They were still just above average as far as their overall defensive ratings. But how long is it going to take when you think about all the additions here? Jordan Brooks, Shaq Barrett at linebacker. You are investing heavily in Chop Robinson as your first-round draft pick to help fortify that position that is now certainly with some holes. When you think about Jalen Phillips, who was a great edge and is coming back from injury, we don't know the status of him and how close to 100% he'll be at the start of the year. When you lose Xander Van Ginkle, who is a solid core piece of that defense for so many years.
He really was.
Xavien Howard, one of the best corners, a shutdown guy at the back end. They'll try to make up for his loss with bringing in Kendall Fuller at the cornerback spot. And you also have Jordan Poyer, a veteran who comes in, stays within the division. But a lot of question marks on that side of the ball. And it also leads into what happens with the offensive line. It has perennially been banged up and underperforming. And it's sort of like how the offensive line goes is sort of how Tua Tagovailoa at quarterback goes, because he's so reliant on the ability to have protection, get the ball out quick and clean passing lanes, that when that is shut down, I mean, his splits, Jared, with no pressure versus pressure, are as stark as anybody in the NFL. And it's why he's such a polarizing guy under center.
I was literally going to pull that up right now, and we'll have time on the other side of this segment, because that is a really good point to make, and that's going to be a big part of my preseason analysis when we continue to dive into this Dolphins team. Is Tua under pressure, Tua not under pressure, Tua under duress, Tua not under duress. It's a completely different animal. I will say this. I like their offensive line when healthy. Armstead and Jackson are very solid tackles. I think Eichenberg and Brewer are two very versatile guys in the middle that you don't want any of them to be hurt. But if one of them does get hurt, I think you can replace one with the other. The guards, I don't know much about. Wynn, I feel like, did he come from New England?
He did.
And in Jones, I'm not familiar. I think if you want a good thought exercise before you head into the season, look at the teams and the players that no one else is looking at. Offensive line. If you, I always say, if you want to be taken seriously in the NFL analysis space and you can't break down an offensive line of a team, then you've only done half of your work. And I know the offensive linemen don't get the pub that the receivers and the quarterbacks get, but I promise you, you as a handicapper will get way more value looking into the offensive lines of teams and the defensive lines and how much pressure they generate and how much pressure they can stop other teams from generating. I think that analysis infinitely more valuable than how many passing yards a guy can throw in a game. That's easy. Anyone can do that. Look at the offensive lines, try to figure out where the holes are, and try to figure out if the scheme matches what the team is trying to do. I think, to me, that's where you start and end every... And listen, the Dolphins are a very, I'll call them, regimented unit. They have a quick passing game. They obviously can push the ball down the field, but it's a Kyle Shanahan passing offense. It's quick. It's got these gadgets and gizmos. Like, it is very tough to defend in space. If Tua is the ringleader for the whole season, I feel very bullish on the Dolphins' chances of making the playoffs.
Yeah.
The offensive line is going to be a big part of that.
It's funny, too. You look at, you know, again, I'm looking through all these positional rankings. PFF has Miami 18th, and that was largely due to, look, how do you separate talent from scheme, right? You've got great, great talent, but you mentioned a guy in Terron Armstead missed 11 games over the last 2 years. How healthy can you stay? What's funny is Sharp Football also does these positional rankings. They have Miami 25th, but you know, they have a bunch of different voters within that panel. Miami votes on the offensive line were as high as 8th, as low as 32nd. I mean, so at least if you're going into the season, that gives you as a better an idea of, okay, there is a wide range of outcomes for this offensive line. But if quarterback is often so tied to success of that offensive line, if there is a wide range of outcomes as is perceived like that, I'm naturally going to be a little bit more pessimistic in that quarterback to take such a giant leap, as some people do believe in the betting space. If you do believe, I looked up that number one seed odds, Jared, for you. 10-1, Miami to get the number one seed.
And that's lower than what their AFC price is, which doesn't surprise me. Because to me, you're not winning the AFC unless you're the one seed. I got the Tua numbers, too. Keep clean and pressure. We can hit them up.
We will discuss those when we come back. Continuing our AFC East breakdowns, we'll get some closing thoughts on the Dolphins. Start in on the Jetropolitans of New York when we come back.
This is Sharp Money with Patrick Maher on VSiN, the Sports Betting Network.
You should go to VSiN.com right now to take a look at all of our best bets, betting splits, exclusive articles, odds by states, betting tools, and betting guides. Adam Burke, our managing editor of the website, VSiN.com, has the rest of his Thursday MLB plays up and available right now. We also have breakdowns on the Wimbledon men's semifinals. We're going to talk about that a little bit later in the show with Zach Cohen, who's breaking down Daniil Medvedev versus Carlos Alcaraz, as well as Lorenzo Musetti and Novak Djokovic for tomorrow. It's optimized for mobile. It's a fresh new look. Check it out. VSiN.com. Back here from the home of the best betting game in Las Vegas, Sigma Derby. Bar Canada at the D.
People are going bananas today.
Jared
this is
Smith.
The first day it's back since we've been here.
It's back. Sigma Derby had its own all-star
it's
break.
It's packed. Look, and, check out this thing right now. Go check that camera.
Yeah, there's like, a lot going on.
There's as many people in the entire casino as there are playing that game right now. It's crazy.
I once on a bachelor party ended up spending 4 hours at a Sigma Derby machine, and it was so captivating. It was so captivating.
What's more captivating, Paul Skeens or Sigma Derby?
I think. Well, also it was one of those weekends. It was so busy. It was around March. I think it was a weekend of March Madness and a Taylor Swift concert in Vegas. And I mean, it was like Fremont was just swimming. So you think of a big group of guys, you're like, oh, let's all take over a craps table. It's like, yeah, that's not going to happen when it's so busy. So we found the next best thing, which was take over a Sigma Derby table. I had a great time.
I think Sigma Derby is...
Did I shake it off? No, I did not.
Okay.
It looks like it's a young group that I like. So, you know, let's be honest. The downtown can get a very eclectic mix of demographics. Usually this casino skews a little bit older. This is all younger peeps here hanging out. So they probably weren't even alive when this game was made, which is ironic.
I mean, but I was not alive.
I don't know if I was.
You know, I mean, this is
1986.
It was eight. Wasn't it 80? Yeah, you said 86. Why?
So it was made the year I was born, and I'm pushing 40.
85.
It came out 1985.
I was not born when this game was created.
Hey, don't rip the young people.
I guess technically I'm one of them in this scenario. Compared to Sigma Derby, I'm a baby.
You are, yes, you're a minnow in that regard. What a great game. What a great game.
Awesome stuff.
A lot of people were not, were also not born yet when Aaron Rodgers was ascending the high school ranks and eventually the Chino Community, Butte Community College ranks, and then Chino, California. And now here he is, Aaron Rodgers. He's still in the league, and his team, the New York Jets, this year, super polarizing. We're going to get to them in a second. We wanted to close out first, though, the Miami Dolphins talk with the numbers you pulled up, Jared. We were talking Tua under pressure versus not under pressure, based on how his offensive line perceived to have such a wide range of outcomes this year. What are those numbers spitting out?
Well, another pro tip, Pro Football Focus, I think, is worth. I have many subscriptions. Actually, this is one that someone else pays for through an old job. But I have, I have many.
I'll give you my Netflix. Exchange.
Yeah. I have many subscriptions to many different data service websites. That if you do what we do every day, I think they're better talking points. But sometimes you find nuggets that are actionable. This isn't necessarily one of those nuggets. This is more of a talking point nugget. But again, it speaks to the importance of the offensive line for the Dolphins. When Tua was kept clean last year, 75% of his dropbacks, he was kept clean last year. 28 touchdowns, 12 picks. He had a 94 Pro Football Focus rating, which is elite. 27 big-time throws, which is significant. And a 3% turnover-worthy play rate. Very good. Almost 9 yards per attempt. Under pressure, a quarter of his dropbacks last year, a little over 100 of his dropbacks last year were under duress, 5.3 yards per attempt, so almost half what it is kept clean. 2 touchdowns, 3 picks, a 51 Pro Football Focus rating, nearly half his Pro Football Focus rating under pressure compared to being kept clean, a turnover-worthy play rate of 4%, so up about a full percent from what it is when he is under
all valuable context.
Very valuable Dolphins. Context.
It's funny too, because as we transition into the Jets, while Aaron Rodgers has always been tremendous with or without pressure, I find it fascinating and a little bit hard to totally get all the way there on as one small element of this hype train that is the New York Jets, who are 9.5 on a win total, heavy juice to the over at -150, is the fact that this was one of the worst offensive line situations in football last year. It was not talked about because after Aaron Rodgers had his Achilles injury on the fourth snap from scrimmage in week one, all that was talked about was just the abysmal play at quarterback, but this was as bad as it got as far as offensive line situations last year. Yet, when you look at some of these early season positional rankings, PFF, Jets, fifth best O-line in their rankings, Sharp Football, tied for sixth this year, with the big ad being, you know, Tyron Smith coming over as a veteran tackle. You bring in Morgan Moses as well, Elijah Vera Tucker, very solid interior guard for you, but just like last year when the Jets had optimism, and yet you're talking Dwayne Brown on the outside. You're talking about elder statesmen. Can you hold up in a very, very difficult division for the 17-game season all the way into January and make a postseason run? I find myself skeptical that we have to see it a little bit more before we say the Jets are this top five unanimous offensive line when they were so, so bad last year. And just because Rodgers is back and healthy does not automatically equate to success on that O-line.
I agree with your sentiment, but I think you have to be optimistic because they poured more resources into the O-line than maybe any other team did. Not only did they bring in two guys, I don't want to say off the scrap heap. I mean, Terrence Smith had a really good career. I think it's just the injuries and the durability with him that's the concern. Moses on the other side, I would say, is a journeyman. But then you draft a guy that you hope could be one of the tackles of the future, and Olufoshano out of Penn State, who I think coming in, I think it was the hand size that was the knock. I don't know. I know there was like a knock on him coming into the draft that is the reason why he was going to fall, but I had a chance to watch him very closely at Penn State. This guy has been talked about for years as a top offensive lineman prospect. I would say the last 2 years, we've been waiting for him to kind of blossom into that role. And I think, I want to say he was a junior that came out a year early. So he's a young guy and he has a chance to improve. Maybe he doesn't have to start week one. Maybe it's Moses and Smith on the outside. And then you have an ace in the hole, a guy that you can bring along slowly with two veterans. And again, I think if you talk about the men, we talk about this all the time at the quarterback situation. You want a rookie quarterback to have a mentor, even if he's not the starting mentor, even if he's just the backup and he's a mentor and can groom the starting quarterback, because there's a lot that goes on between the ears there. I think the same could be said about any other position in the NFL, especially a left tackle situation, which is like the most important position besides quarterback, I think, on the offense to groom Fashanu. Well, I would say Terrence Smith is one of the best players. He had a ton of experience, played in Dallas for a number of years in front of a really good offensive line around him. So I think the situation is immensely better. Does that mean results? Does that mean they finish the year top 10 in, you know, pass rush, you know, or pass blocking, yeah, win rate, run block, all those win rate stats that we look at now? Maybe. But I think you have to be optimistic based off of the moves that they made.
That's fair. I always look at when you're talking O-lines that invested a lot, right? And Cincinnati's a great example of this from a couple of years ago. They finally said, okay, we cannot let Joe Burrow lead the league in sacks. So they spent a ton of money, brought in some really good, stout offensive linemen. It took some time. It took till about week 7, week 8 for that.
Sure.
That's a relationship to really gel. Well, what's the issue here for the Jets and why I'm a little bit pessimistic, at least to the point of, you know, I'm not going to be laying $1.50 on them to go over. To me, that has been priced to a point where it's ridiculous and the tax is out of control at this point. You've got an unprecedented 6 primetime games the first 11 weeks plus a London trip. I mean, scheduling is just miserable. It's by far the worst, you know, rest edge of any team in the NFL. It's criminal what the NFL has done here to the Jets. At the same time, I'm sure the NFL is going, hey, we got robbed all this money of primetime games thanks to Rodgers' injury. So we're going to try to recoup that and then some right away. But that is not an easy way to start your year when you are trying to get so many pieces acclimated and ready to go early on. And if this was a softer opening, Jared, to schedule, I would feel a little bit more confident. And okay, you can work out some things while you get your offensive line all set, but I mean, this is tough. You go to San Francisco right out of the gate. I mean, a back-to-back road games to start, short week at Tennessee. You get a short week, you know, even though it's New England, it's your first home game comes on a short week after you've had back-to-back road games. It's just not an optimal setup. And that's why you probably want to look at alternative ways to bet this for the Jets in 2024, as opposed to a win total that is really taxed based on the hype through the moon when, you know, the schedule certainly does not indicate that. And while you are right, Jared, there's a lot of reason to be optimistic. So many great skill position players. And ultimately, this is a team that should be right there competing for a playoff and a divisional championship this year. It's going to take time. And to invest preseason when you don't know anything yet, to me, is a little bit putting the cart before the horse.
I wouldn't invest preseason at these prices. That's for sure. Yeah. I'll tell you something I am intrigued in. And our pal Will Hill gave me this bet. I want to say it was 2 weeks ago. Maybe it was a week ago. And the more I look at it, the more I like it, because I do think they're live week one. That's as fresh as they're going to be. I know the Niners are good, but let's be honest. That's a winnable game for the Jets if they play at their best level, especially because of the unknowns of the first week of the season. I think dogs are always more live week one anyways. But then you look at the rest of that little stretch there, and I could let's live in a world for a minute that they win that game in San Francisco. I could absolutely see them starting 5-6-0. You get the Bills at home in that week 6 game in prime time. They're 18-1 to be the last undefeated team. You knock the Niners out right out of the gate with that week 1 game. You got the Lions that still have a very soft schedule early. But if we're trying to find creative ways to invent value with a number that's already been bet to high heaven.
Sure.
You got to get a little creative here.
I'm with you. Well, and look, it's talking about looking at the extremes, right, on the variance. What is a logical outcome to the good and to the bad? And we've kind of broken down those two outcomes. It's very, very real for the Jets in 2024. When we come back, we'll continue some more AFC East preview thoughts by going to the Buffalo Bills right after this.
This is Sharp Money with Patrick Maher on VSIN, the sports betting network.
Back on Sharp Money as we continue our AFC East breakdowns in the NFL on this July 11th. We're also tracking some live MLB Day Baseball. One final to report, Paul Skeens goes to 6-0 in his first 11 starts. Jared, I mean, it was ridiculous today. 99 pitches, 7 innings, no hits. Wow. 1 walk, 11 strikeouts. Skeens dropping now across the market. You got a last-second bet in on 18-1 for Skeens to win NL Cy Young. He is now down 2.
14-1 at MGM. So I knew that, again, there are certain books, and it's not a knock on these books, but you profile them. You know which books move fast, move slow. The live futures markets are becoming a thing. And there's certain books that just move slow. Like once DraftKings moved down to 14-1 and MGM was still hanging 18-1, like it was obvious that one was going to come down. Here's the nugget on Skeen from Sarah Langs, who of course does an awesome job as one of the editorial content producers with MLB and ESPN. Paul Skeen's 14 runs allowed, fewest of the 11 pitchers with at least 80 strikeouts in their first 11 career appearances since 1901.
Oh, man.
So that guy, that 1901 rookie, but what was his name? Bump Phillips, whatever his name was. What was his name?
I got to find that.
I don't even know what his name was. Whatever that guy's name was, Bumpus Jones. Yeah. I was close. Bumpus Phillips, same thing. That's obviously Wade Phillips' dad. But I think you look at what Skeens is doing now, like he is in that Fernando Valenzuela territory. Like he's in that, and that's the last, I think that's the last rookie to win Cy Young. I think that's the only rookie that's ever won Cy Young. But we're way past the rookie of the year. Like that's already in his back pocket. Now it's, can he win the Cy Young? What does he need to do to win the Cy Young? Is the innings the only thing that will prevent him from winning the Cy Young? I think yes. I think we're half baking the innings number right now. But I mean, it's historic.
What's amazing about Bumpus Jones is that was he pitched on the last day. He made his major league debut, signed off the Sandlots.
Okay.
The final day of the season, and it was the last year that the mound was at 55 feet 6 inches.
Yeah, something tells me he had an advantage.
They would push it 5 feet back, and they signed him the next year. The next year, he went 1-4 with a 10.19 ERA and never pitched again.
Now, the only thing I'm thinking of is what Skeen's numbers would be if he was pitching with a 55-foot mound.
Oh, gosh. 5 feet mound. It's like when they do the soft back.
No one would be able to touch it. He would pitch 27 up, 27
Jenny Finch's
down.
Heyday in the softball when they would do the MLB equivalent. It was always like 101 miles an hour, and you're like, this is literally unfair. You cannot.
A 55 foot mound. Imagine what some of the guys, even the guys that aren't in the current era. Imagine what a Randy Johnson or a Nolan Ryan would have done with a 55. That's why any number before, again, when they moved the mound up,
yeah,
or moved it down, excuse me, any number before that, it's like they're playing a different game. Any record before that, pitching-wise, is like, why are you even going to take it serious? It's a completely different game.
From my research, I also found that George Nicol in 1890 and Red Ames in 1903 also had no-hitters in their first game, although they did not go a full nine innings in their major league debuts back
then. The Blue Jays are making Jordan Hicks look very average today. So here's the trick on Jordan
Jays
Hicks.
In the fourth.
They've been hanging his outs number in the 15.5, 16.5 range all season. I think he's gone under in every start but two. Because he just throws too many pitches. He walks too many guys. He's a converted reliever, of course, pitched for the Cardinals for a number of years. Giants got him now. He's a starter. And he just does not have the ability to be stretched out deep in games. I might be wrong on the amount, but I think he's under in 13 out of his, like, 17 starts this year. Like,
his numbers, his overall numbers aren't bad, but it's because
4 out of 19. So he's 15.
He hasn't gone all that deep.
15-4 to the under. And now if he's not going to go past five innings today, he's 77 pitches in the fourth. So it's going to be 20 starts this year. 16 unders on the outs prop. I mean, it's free money. And they haven't moved it. It's been 16.5, 15.5. But that doesn't matter as much to me because that means you're starting the sixth inning, and he doesn't get that sixth inning love a whole lot.
77 pitches through 3 2/3. Two on, two
no
out there. Down
4-2
in the top of the fourth. We will finish up our AFC East breakdown with the Buffalo Bills. We'll save them till last year, but we were talking during the break and think it's worthy of bringing it up right now. Within this division where there is so much hype, there is a team that's on an island here, and it's the New England Patriots with the lowest win total in the NFL, favored to have the fewest wins, favored to be the last winless team as well. But that has already been baked in. There are also other ways, though, you can bet this stuff here, Jared. And for the Patriots, it's also goes into the question of, A, are they going to be as bad as anticipated moving on from Bill Belichick in the first year of Jerod Mayo with all sorts of young players across the positional groups from left to right on both sides of the ball? And then, B, are there ways you can profit and make smart bets when you have a team that is projected to be so poorly as the Patriots are right now?
It's been bet down pretty hard. I saw some of our pals in the Sharp community, once that alt win total came out under, they really hammered it hard. I would still play it. In fact, I saw an under 5.5 at stations, very juiced. But how, like, look, let's pull the schedule. Where are their six wins on this schedule? I mean, I don't even understand how you even consider a six-win a season for them. They open as nearly double-digit dogs at Cincinnati. Obviously, that's going to be the healthiest Joe Burrow is probably going to be all year. They're going to lose that game. Then they have to play Seattle at home. I think that's the only winnable game, frankly, in their first eight. Then they play at the Jets. And the part of the value equation here for the Patriots that is hard for the market to totally take into account is the angst factor of all of these teams that have been terrorized by Bill Belichick and Tom Brady for the last two decades. Now the shoe's on the other foot. Like, they are going to want to stick it to the Patriots. You think the Jets and the Dolphins and the Bills, who have been looking up, and I know recently that trend has obviously changed, but for the most part, the Patriots have dominated this division for the better part of two decades. It feels like one of those years where the bottom could fall out because they're really bad at quarterback. We have no idea what Drake May is. The schedule is very difficult. I mean, you tell me where there's a win before they play the Titans in week 9. They got the Bengals, the Seahawks. I think that's the only winnable game. By the way, they're a 2.5-point dog. At the Jets on Thursday night, they're not winning that game. At the Niners following, they're not winning that game. They're not beating the Dolphins, especially if they can't keep up with Tua in that offense. Texans are going to be a tough game. They're at home. Maybe that's one where they can steal if C.J. Stroud and the Texans come back to earth a little bit. Then they got to go to London and face the Jags. Then they play the Jets again. To me, this looks like 0-8, maybe 1-7 best case scenario, but I think under 4.5 is very much still in play.
Yeah, and those the 5.5s, by the way, and they're out there, like you said, at DK, it's minus 205. I mean, it's big juice on the 5.5.
But also, 205 is telling you 60%, 66%. I think it's like 80 or 90% that they ain't getting the 6 wins this year. So I know you don't want to sit on that for 6 months. I get it. But if they're that bad, I might be willing to sit on it for six months. It's basically like a certificate of deposit.
I would also add another way to play these. Now that books hang lines for future weeks in advance here, one of the bets that a lot of very smart bettors will tell you is a very, very good wager to make is, say, look at a week 2 game or the games of the years right in college football. You mentioned the Patriots, their home opener. They're 2.5-point home dogs to Seattle. So you're right up butting up against a key number there. Seattle gets Denver at home week 1. Likely Bo Nix making his pro debut.
Probably.
While you have New England, a big, big dog on the road at Cincinnati.
Yep.
Projecting out here, Jared, it's a very tough place for a rookie quarterback to go on the road and win in Seattle to start things off. Even if you're not all that high on Seattle, you win a game week 1 if you're the Seahawks. You are likely going to look very, very tepid at best if you're New England on the road against Cincinnati. It is hard for me to believe that by the time we get to week 2, even though it's a 1-game sample size and we always talk about overreactions into the market, that at the very least Seattle's not laying 3, if not more than a field goal on the road in New England.
I love that.
To the point that a week 2 bet before the season starts on Seahawks laying less than 3 on the road is a good bet to make.
I love that analysis. I did the exact same thing with the Ravens last year, their week 2 game against Cincinnati. They were catching 3.5, I think, pre-flop, and then the week 1 games happened and Cincinnati didn't look as good. And Baltimore looked good, and then we get to the actual game, and it was down to 3. So I think that's a really good way to look at the market. The biggest moves you'll see, barring injury, happen between week 1 and 2, just based off a pure power rating switch, because it's our first look at these teams. I talk to pro bettors who say after week 2, they throw their priors out, gone, if it's drastic difference from what they thought it was going to be compared to what we're seeing after 2 games. So week 1 to week 2, especially considering the volatility and the news cycle as volatile as it is these days, you will see big moves between the the week 2 games that come out in the summer. And then once you actually get to, let's say, the Monday before week 2, when you play that first Monday night game, that's when the look ahead lines will pop back up Sunday night into Monday morning. That's when you'll see a very big shift.
I think it's something I've tried to do as a bettor of just think a little bit outside the box here.
That's the only way to find value.
The markets are so robust now.
Yes.
That just simply going in, it can be like for me, I'm a very kind of, analytical thinker. It's kind of straight to how I've always bet. And it's like, oh, I want to go week by week and do it the traditional way. But you kind of realize, to your point, you find the value when you start
bets
to go outside the box.
A good bet is a good bet. It doesn't matter if it's a good bet in 6 months, if it's a good bet tomorrow, if it's a good bet next week. A good bet's a good bet. But you're right. The average bettor wants that money. They want that instant gratification right away.
Yes, they do. When we come back, it is our final hour of Sharp Money. We will take a couple of deep dives into a number of different topics. But up first, Andy Backstrom from Ohio State, a beat writer for On3.com and Letterman Road, joins us to talk about the Big Ten and Ohio State football in 2024.